Yesterday, we heard about the many ways in which some groups of Americans might be prevented from voting. Today, we're going to look beyond November the 3rd and ask, what happens if the result is contested? How much does Donald Trump hate losing?
You know, I can't exactly speculate on his personal psychology, but there is one story that I remember being told about Trump as a very young boy.
Across the Narrows, the entrance to New York Harbor, the longest suspension bridge in the world. Its main span between towers measuring 4,260 feet is ready for its opening.
When he was taken by his father to the opening of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge.
In brilliant cold sunshine, a dream becomes a reality, with plaudits for the man most responsible for fulfilling that long-held dream, Othmar H. Amman, 85-year-old master bridge builder.
And I believe the architect during this opening ceremony rather modestly stood towards the back of the crowd and was not demanding a lot of attention. And Donald Trump's father pointed out to the young Donald, this architect, who was being quite modest, and said, "Do you know what that man is?" And I guess the little boy went like, "What?" And the father said, "He's a loser." I think that's been kind of a pattern through his entire life. Winning is something that is essential to the brand. And the brand is Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is the brand.
It's an observation that plenty of others have made about Donald Trump over the years, including his opponent in 2016.
There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged against
him. Should have gotten it.
This is a mindset. This is how Donald thinks. And it's funny, but it's also really troubling.
Troubling, perhaps, and certainly high stakes. Americans have already started voting ahead of the presidential election on November the 3rd. What usually happens is that the votes are counted, one candidate concedes, and there is a peaceful transition of power. But with this type of talk...
Can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes.
This time round, we can't take it for granted. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, if Donald Trump loses, will he actually concede? Lawrence Douglas, you're a professor of law at Amherst College, Massachusetts. You write for The Guardian and you've published a book called Donald Trump, Will He Go? About whether the president would actually step down if he loses. Interestingly, the rhetoric we're hearing now isn't new. He was working from the same script in 2016.
I would like to promise and pledge to all of my voters and supporters and to all of the people of the United States that I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election if I win.
Was there a moment back then when you started worrying about what you were hearing?
Well, I think many Americans were pretty gobsmacked by the last presidential debate that he conducted with Hillary Clinton. Chris Wallace said, "Will you accept the results no matter what?
Do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely, sir, that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?"
And I think Trump just kind of refused to commit.
"I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time."
And then Chris Wallace pushed him a little harder on that. And Trump rather notoriously answered,
"I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense."
I remember watching that and thinking, wow, that's an astonishing thing to hear the candidate of a major party say. And I have to say, at the time, I also thought, wow, he's finished. You cannot refuse to accept electoral results. That's just kind of attacking basic norms of constitutional democracy. So I kind of thought at the time that he was nailing his own coffin shut, and so much for my prognostications.
But even when he won, this theme continued from him, didn't it?
Yes, it did. In fact, right after his election, I actually started writing as a contributing opinion writer to The Guardian. And the very first piece I wrote was about his claim that he had, in fact, won the popular vote as well, except for the fact that there were these 3 to 5 million phantom illegal voters.
He has stated that before. I think he stated his concerns of voter fraud and people voting illegally during the campaign. And he continues to maintain that belief based on studies and evidence that people have presented to him.
Press Secretary Sean Spicer doubling down on the president's claim, but repeatedly unable to point to evidence that backs up the charge that has been debunked by Republicans and Democrats alike.
And in this piece that I wrote from The Guardian, I really tried to ask, well, what are the politics behind a claim like that? I mean, not only did he threaten to dispute the outcome of the election if he lost, he's disputing the outcome of an election that he won. What if in 4 years' time he trotted out a similar type of argument, not to, for the purposes of challenging his loss in the popular vote, but challenging his loss in the Electoral College vote? The damage to the system could be hard to exaggerate.
Okay, so things feel quite different this time, because in the run-up to this election, he basically got asked that same question again, didn't he? And he responded similarly.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
We want to make sure the election is honest, and I'm not sure that it can be. I don't know that it can be.
On top of that, he's got a lot to say about the workings of the election itself. What is his argument? And how much does it change now that he's the incumbent president?
Well, for one thing, he has spent the last 3.5 years telling the American people that our electoral system is unreliable, which, again, is a kind of unprecedented act in American history. And what Trump has done is he's kind of created this heads I win, tails you lose situation in which the only way that the system can demonstrate its legitimacy is if he wins. And if he loses, well, that simply becomes proof of what he's been saying all along.
And we were hearing in yesterday's episode that Donald Trump is really hitting out at the postal vote system, and in particular states that automatically send out mail-in ballots to voters. Why politically is he focusing on this issue?
And there's a particular demographic that we need to pay attention to with respect to these mail-in ballots. A recent poll indicated, I think, that around 20 to 25% of Trump supporters intend to vote by mail-in ballots. That compares to about 55 to 60% of Biden voters who are going to vote by mail-in ballot. So we can see that Trump is kind of tactically trying to discredit votes that are going to break against him.
It's very, very unfair to our country. If they do this, our country will be a laughingstock all over the world, because everyone knows it doesn't work. How many ballots is he sending in California? Is it 28 million or some massive number? Other states are sending out millions and millions of ballots. I don't want to see a crooked election. This election will be the most rigged election in history.
On top of the rhetoric, we know that some states are placing a lot of obstacles in the way of mail-in ballots, meaning many may end up not being counted. If the result on the night indicates a landslide either way, then a lot of these controversies may melt away. But given the sheer number of postal votes, this huge surge because of COVID, it is reasonably likely, isn't it, that the overnight result will remain in the balance. So how long will it take to count the mail-in ballots?
It could take days or even weeks to fully count these mail-in ballots. And one of the reasons is that we really don't have a nationalized election system. Everything is kind of left up to the states. So, for example, the state of Colorado begins counting their mail-in ballots as soon as they arrive. And yet the key swing states in the election, let's say Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, according to their state laws, they're not even allowed to begin counting the mail-in ballots until Election Day itself. And so what we're likely to see is that, given the kind of demographic split that I just mentioned a little earlier, the fact that many more Trump supporters will be voting in person on November 3rd, and many more Biden supporters will be voting by mail-in ballots, which might not be counted until days or even weeks after the election, we could easily imagine Trump having a lead on November 3rd. And what I really think his strategy is to try to leverage whatever lead he has on November 3rd into a claim that he's been reelected, and then to try to discredit this so-called blue shift, this shift in overall voting towards the Democrats, towards Biden, once the mail-in ballots start to be counted. He'll try to discredit that as the product of a fraud. And I really don't think that's a speculative strategy. I think Trump has all but telegraphed that's what his intentions are.
I want to have the election, but I also don't want to have to wait for 3 months and then find out that the ballots are all missing and the election doesn't mean anything. That's what's going to happen, Steve. That's common sense. And everyone knows it. Smart people know it. Stupid people may not know it. And some people don't want to talk about it, but they know it.
And that's something that I think the media in the United States needs to really prepare the American people to accept. We tend to watch the election results on election day the way we watch the Super Bowl or the way you might watch the Champions League final. And we expect to know who the winner is by the time we go to sleep. And that is not likely to be the case on November 3rd. And I think they need to remind the American people that the fact that they cannot make any predictions, they cannot declare a winner on November 3rd, is not an example of a system malfunctioning. It's simply the necessary consequence of a system properly functioning in a time of pandemic.
And it's obvious why, if the Republicans are ahead on the night or if it's in the balance, Donald Trump would want to try to declare victory as soon as possible before mail-in ballots that we know are likely to lean Democrat are counted. But clearly there is the opposite pressure for Joe Biden to make sure that every single postal vote is counted. And in fact, Hillary Clinton is among those who have urged him not to concede on the night.
Joe Biden should not concede under any circumstances because I think this is going to drag out. And eventually, I do believe he will win if we don't give an inch.
During any scenario like this, things are likely to get incredibly tense. What could start happening as the counting continues?
There'll no doubt be a lot of litigation around the count of these mail-in ballots. And the reason I say a litigation, there are reasons to disqualify mail-in ballots. And one of the reasons for disqualifying is if they haven't been submitted in a timely fashion. And I think this is another dot that we need to connect. There are many states that say for a mail-in ballot to be counted, let's say it has to arrive by Election Day itself, November 3rd. If it arrives in November 4th, that vote will be disqualified. And it will be disqualified even if the failure to arrive was the result not of the mailer having waited to the last second, but as a result of an overtaxed postal service having failed to deliver the ballot in a timely fashion.
Again, we heard yesterday that Trump and his ally running the postal service had been accused of deliberately stripping out funds that would slow down mail delivery. They obviously deny that. But are you really saying that late ballots and legal challenges to the postmarks could swing this election?
Well, for example, if we go back to the year 2000, remember that was the election between George W. Bush and Al Gore. And that election ended up turning on the results in a single key swing state, in that case, Florida. And remember the margin of victory that ultimately handed Bush the White House was 537 votes. And there were all sorts of questions about votes that had been disqualified. For example, there was this antiquated voting system in Broward County that kind of almost looked like you had these punch cards, and the punch cards had these so-called hanging chads, you know, these pieces of paper that hadn't actually been fully removed. And the question is, well, if the paper hasn't been fully removed, Is that a qualified vote or not?
The Chads that are being dimpled during the counting process that are then objected to and are now being counted are tainted ballots.
You find ballots that can clearly have a discernible intent of the voter found from them, and yet they're not counted.
It's not good for the country that it lingers on this way.
This is a time to respect every voter and every vote.
And again, you could imagine similar things happening in this election season if, again, the election turns on narrow margins in swing states. And instead of worrying about hanging chads this time around, we're going to be worrying about mail-in ballots.
And when we get to this stage, does the Supreme Court have a role? And if so, is that why Donald Trump has been so determined to get his nomination in?
The Supreme Court could certainly play a role again.
The U.S. Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in favor of George Bush apparently spelling the end to Al Gore's chance for the presidency.
That is, if there's a question about whether mail-in ballots that have missed the statutory submission date should be counted or not, that question will no doubt be litigated. And it could be litigated all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it is possible that Trump's nominees to the Supreme Court, including the nominee Amy Coney Barrett, who hasn't yet been confirmed, could play a role in deciding that issue, and in deciding that issue, in deciding the election itself.
So a Supreme Court that has suddenly got a big lean towards the right.
That's exactly right. Even though I do want to emphasize that our present Supreme Court is incredibly conservative, and we also have to recognize that a third of it is comprised of nominees of Trump himself. But whether they would dependably vote for Trump, I'm not entirely certain about that.
Okay, so what you're basically describing is an election in 2020 like no other, not even like 2000, where we could be in a situation where it won't be decided on the night and there could be days, if not weeks, of chaos with neither side willing to concede. How worried should we be about what might be happening on the streets of America during that period?
I think we need to be very worried. And in fact, if we can just go back to the year 2000 just for a moment, I don't want your listeners to think that, well, it was the Supreme Court that really settled that election dispute, even though the court did intervene to stop the Florida recount. But it really wasn't the court that settled that dispute. It was Al Gore himself, who very graciously conceded on the day after the Supreme Court rendered its pretty transparently partisan decision.
I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country.
Al Gore, I think, ultimately put the interests of the nation ahead of his own political fortunes. And I think it's impossible to imagine a Donald Trump acting in like fashion. And I think it's very possible that we could see some really ugly scenes on the streets of the United States in the weeks after November 3rd. And even in this presidential debate, when asked whether he would condemn white supremacists, Trump again refused to do so, and indeed made this coy and, in fact, quite abhorrent statement of saying, you know, Proud Boys,
stand back and
stand by. And that standby message, I mean, this is the kind of dog whistle politics that Trump has perfected, which could really kind of send out a signal to his supporters to take to the streets and to do so in a violent fashion.
Coming up, how votes in the Electoral College could also become controversial. So, Lawrence, it's clear there could be a lot of dispute over which votes are actually counted. But there is another layer of complexity here, isn't there? The Electoral College system. We know that there's a total of 538 Electoral College votes divided up among the 50 states, with the more populous states having a greater share. The winner of the election needs a majority of over 270. But who's involved in that process?
So when I go to vote, for example, I'm not really voting for Joe Biden or for Donald Trump. I'm voting for a slate of electors pledged to Trump or to Biden. And those electors, they're actually human beings. They tend to simply be ceremonial figures who are picked by the party. They tend to be, you know, party muckety-mucks, big donors. And if, for example, in my state of Massachusetts, if Biden wins, then on December 14th in the state capital of Boston, the electors who are pledged to Biden, they will convene in Boston and they will cast their Electoral College votes for Joe Biden. And those votes, very quaintly, will be sent by certified mail to Congress, and they will be then opened up and counted by a joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021.
Not very modern.
No, it's not very modern at all. States end up electing the president. And whoever carries the popular vote in a state, regardless of how tiny a margin, that candidate receives all that state's electoral college votes, regardless of how small the margin of victory is within that state. And so you could have an entire national election turn on the result in one or a handful of swing states. In 2016, Donald Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes nationally, and yet he won the Electoral College because he carried Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania by a total of 78,000 votes, which is a minuscule margin. And so that is one of the reasons that the system can create these very, very peculiar results.
And in this scenario that we're imagining, is there a clear schedule for how all of this plays out?
Yes. Two dates, December 14th and December 8th. On December 14th, electors throughout the country convene in their various state capitals, as I kind of mentioned, Massachusetts, they would go to Boston, and they would cast their Electoral College votes. Well, in order for the electors to go to the state capitals to vote, the states need to know who has carried their state. So they need to know whether it's Biden's electors that are going to Boston or Trump's electors that are going to Boston. And they basically have, by federal law in this election season, they have until December 8th in order to figure out who has carried their state. Now, in the case of these mail-in ballots that could be muddied in the count, in which the count could be delayed by rounds and rounds of litigation, it's possible to imagine the following. If you look, for example, at the key swing states of Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, they're all controlled by Republican legislatures, and they all have Democratic governors. And the reason that's key is because if the outcome of the state remains murky, and you start approaching this December 8th deadline, it's possible to imagine that the Republican legislatures will say, look, we need to go with these earlier results. We believe that Trump has carried our state, and we're going to certify Trump as the winner. And we're going to send his electoral certificate on to Congress. You could imagine the Democratic governors of the same states arriving at the exact opposite outcome, concluding that no, Biden has actually carried our state. It took a long time for us to finish these mail-in ballot counts, but ultimately it seems that Biden has prevailed. We're going to certify him as the winner and send his electoral certificate on to Congress. Then comes January 6, 2021, this joint session of Congress when Congress counts the Electoral College votes and declares a winner. And suddenly you have these conflicting certificates from three key swing states with the election in the balance, and we don't have a president-elect.
But who is more important? Who makes the decision, the governor or the legislature?
Well, we have to go back to this Electoral Count Act of 1887, which I have to say is a disastrously poorly crafted piece of legislation. And the short answer to the question as to whose certificate counts, the governor's or the legislature's, is it depends.
It depends on what?
It depends a little bit on when the certificate has been submitted. For example, if,
you couldn't make this up, could you?
No, you can't make it up. You really can't make it up. So if it's the case that the legislator's certificate is, let's say, submitted on December 7th and the governor's on December 15th, well, it looks like it's the legislators that could count. But if it's the case that the legislators and the governor's certificates are both submitted on December 15th, then it looks like the governor's certificate would count. And then, of course, it raises the question of who decides whether it would count. Well, it would be Congress itself. And if Congress remains split, then there's not really any mechanism by which to say, oh, well, you have to accept the governors or you have to accept the legislators. It could be the case that a Republican Senate would say, we're going to accept the legislators' certificate for Trump, and that the Democratic-controlled House will say, we're going to accept the governor's certificates for Biden.
But it would be the new Congress. So it would be the Congress that has been voted for on November the 3rd.
Yes. Adding another complication to the whole thing, the Congress that's sworn in on January 3rd, 2021, that will be the Congress that would be responsible for settling this electoral mess that could land in their laps 3 days later on January 6th, 2021.
I mean, my head is spinning. It sounds absolutely bonkers. And in many ways, I don't understand it. I know that the American system, like ours, is archaic. It has its oddities. And at times, like in 2016, the winner of the popular vote doesn't become president. But it is a system that is underpinned by a written constitution. Why doesn't that make the outcome of the election certain either way?
Well, if you have kind of a wild card in the situation, and I think Donald Trump is a wild card, someone who has shown consistently over the last 3.5 years that he does not subscribe to the basic norms of the system, it's very, very difficult to craft any kind of constitutional or legal mechanism that could troubleshoot a situation like this. Ultimately, I think constitutional democracies have to at some point assume the good faith of the principal actors in the system. And if people are not acting in good faith, it's very difficult for the system to protect itself.
But you say Donald Trump has shown that. He's not shown it. He said it. And isn't he really all talk? Is everyone over-worrying here? I mean, if he wins, he'll win. And if he loses, surely, ultimately, the moral pressure on him will be so great that he'll have to go.
I strongly disagree. I think we do need to distinguish between, let's say, conceding defeat and submitting to defeat. So conceding defeat, I kind of mentioned earlier, that's when you recognize you fought the good fight and you lost in a fair contest. I find it impossible to imagine that Trump will concede. That said, is it possible to imagine him submitting to defeat? That is, that he's not going to barricade himself in the Oval Office surrounded by rogue Secret Service agents needing to be frog marched out of the White House on January 20th. Yeah, I can imagine him submitting to defeat, again, if he is beaten decisively and the contours of that decisive defeat are made clear pretty early on. I see him submitting to defeat. And I think, as you point out, there'll be a lot of pressure from other Republican lawmakers for him to submit to the defeat. But if it is the case that the election does turn on these narrow outcomes of late counted mail-in ballots in swing states, then I really could imagine things getting very, very ugly. And I don't think it's right to say that Trump is all talk. I think over the last 3.5 years, we've seen very disturbing instances of him abusing the presidency, the powers of the executive branch. We've seen him basically extort foreign adversaries to dig up dirt on his rival, things that I think would have been unheard of in earlier moments in American history. So I think this guy does pose a pretty substantial danger to our system. But perhaps even more disturbing than his norm breaking is the way in which he has not had to pay a political price for this, not pushing against the norms, but simply kind of smashing straight through them. And that, I think, has been one of the most disturbing aspects of his presidency, the way in which he's been insulated and protected by the Republican Party, by the right-wing media, by Republican lawmakers for his assaults on basic norms of constitutional democracy.
To actually stay in power, even if the election fairly has gone in the opposite direction, wouldn't require just him to behave in that way. It would require quite a lot of different people.
That's exactly right. He himself cannot destabilize or upset the peaceful transfer of power. He would need to have substantial support from Republican lawmakers, and particularly Republican lawmakers in Congress and in the Senate, should the election dispute land in Congress's lap.
I mean, in the end, if what happens is we have weeks of disagreement with Donald Trump and Joe Biden refusing to concede, what happens on Inauguration Day, January the 20th? Do both of them turn up, or is there an ultimate way that this has to be settled?
If you have this kind of conflicting certificates and Congress remains stalemated because it remains divided, remember, Congress only has 2 weeks to figure these things out. Then by the terms of the Presidential Succession Act of 1947, Nancy Pelosi would be inaugurated as acting president of the United States.
What?
Yep, that's correct.
Because she would be leader of the House of Representatives.
That's what the Presidential Succession Act of 1947 contemplates. Now, you might think, oh, well, okay, so at least there's some mechanism to assure a peaceful transfer of power. But again, we have to think about our wild card, which is Donald Trump, who could all along be very aggressively insisting that this is just the radical Dems engaging in a coup to overturn my rightful re-election.
And if that did happen, which I'm sure is not what Donald Trump would be wanting to try to get to by holding out, would you end up with another election?
Nope. Can you call early elections? The short answer is no. There is no mechanism like that. If you had to ask, what is our plan B? We don't have a plan B.
Wow, that is quite a situation to end up in. Lawrence, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Lawrence Douglas, Professor of Law at Amherst College, Massachusetts, who also writes for The Guardian. Do go to the website to look up his pieces. If you haven't heard it yet, then we did refer a few times in this episode to yesterday's Today in Focus with Sam Levine, The Guardian's voting rights reporter, about all the different ways in which certain groups may be prevented from voting. Do have a listen and do also look up Sam's brilliant reporting on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Lawrence Douglas. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.